This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting out of debt. I'm Jason Scott. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, and the hundreds of other supporters who are helping to make this podcast pay down my debts. To some people, I am a celebrity in the technical sphere, a famous archivist or librarian or public speaker, maybe for something else. For a group of people, I'm Sockington the cat. For another group of people, I am something like the guy who goated MySpace, the guy who downloaded GeoCities, the guy who created archive.org. I didn't create archive.org. And the guy who created textfiles.com. And while I personally think that there's a big difference between celebrity and having the ability to get attention, I did want to cover it from the point of view of a quasi-celebrity, both about my thoughts and about hints and ideas about becoming known in some way for what you do, if that's something you need. And I do stress need. Nobody wants this. If you want celebrity, what you probably want is something that celebrity gives you, because celebrity itself is a pretty empty vessel. People just know who you are. But the narrative that comes with it could be completely wonderful, totally unrealistic, or be a terrible thing that you are constantly having to spend the first 10 to 15 seconds of your conversations undoing before you get to anything meaningful. And before I go too far down this road and people start to switch off from this podcast episode, let me say that I recognize that where I am in life comes from both a combination of working hard on things I care about and pure dumb luck, combined with the efforts of many others, seen and unseen, who have helped me in life. It's everything from the teachers who had a conference when I was in middle school to figure out what was going wrong with me personally and emotionally, all the way through to partners and friends who stepped in when they saw something was wrong and made my life better or gave me support, financial or emotional. Everybody is a matrix of support from others, and pretending that you're some sort of lone wolf who went out to a cabin or an abandoned warehouse and built some sort of superhero or supervillain world, that's not a realistic or real thing. And sometimes people portray that externally, simply because it's easier, but it's never the case. Let me talk for a minute about real celebrity, celebrity on the level of a Michael Jackson. Specifically, there's a story that I tell people when I talk about why you really don't want celebrity, and that's the story of Michael Jackson's birthday party. So Michael Jackson was a guy who had millions and millions of dollars and was known throughout the world and could have done anything with his birthday. But he let his agent kind of put something together, and the agent promised, hey, I'm going to do something really special. So late at night, Michael Jackson was blindfolded by his agent and driven somewhere. And this was something like midnight near Michael Jackson's home. And when Michael Jackson had his blindfold taken off, they were in a supermarket. Just a supermarket you might see along a highway or in a community, just straight up rows and rows of food and a shopping basket and everything else. And Michael Jackson's agent had hired dozens of actors and actresses to act like regular people who were shopping. And those people were just going through the motions of being at a supermarket, and their one instruction was to utterly ignore Michael. So there's video footage of Michael Jackson, the king of pop, wandering around a supermarket with absolute glee while his friends are with him, as he looks at different things to buy and goes through the freezer and walks around, and nobody is bothering him. Nobody is asking him for his autograph. Nobody is being weird to him. And he looks at the camera at one point and just says, I've never done this. He'd never had the experience of being left alone at a supermarket to do something. So here's one of the richest people in the world, one of the most famous people in the world, and all he wanted to do was be able to browse shelves. So I always keep that in mind when I think about where celebrity can go. You know, the idea of being able to walk somewhere special or go someplace, because you don't understand how terrible people are when they come up against a world famous image that has been built up across millions. It's not a great life. Celebrities don't have those massive walls and faraway neighborhoods that nobody can get to easily because they don't like people. It's because they can't even live a normal life. Money helps, let's be clear, but there's a certain level of fame where things turn super sour and it becomes a part of your life that is both a burden, a misery, and a ever hungry beast. My level of fame is not so bad. It's a case of being able to tweet something and get a lot of retweets. It's going to certain conferences, conventions, and events and having people walk up and say that they know me or know of my work. And there's cases where I get told about things ahead of other people because I'm known for some sort of archiving and they want me to know so that I can maybe help in some way. It's being able to jump forward 30 or 60 or 120 seconds in the conversation because you don't have to introduce yourself. The closest I have to some sort of celebrity perk, as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that I generally don't like to wear name tags at conferences, and I often won't. And with few exceptions, I can just walk around without a badge and nobody bothers me because they know who I am. But where does all this come from? And like I said, I'm really good at getting attention, which is an ability to make people stop what they're doing and regard what you're up to. And the fact is, that's not a very hard talent. It's just a matter of what the nature of what you're getting attention for is. In my case, I love highlighting and talking about projects of nostalgia, retro history, or saving items that were destined for disappearance, and making people aware that it's both going on and that there's people who care about it, and bridging the gap between everyone kind of knowing something exists and being sure of it and knowing that it's being taken care of. I find that I construct a lot of narratives online. People want to know about what's going on when somebody puts out a piece of news about an old computer being reissued, or a secret cache of historical materials were found, or even something as simple as a website going down and everybody realizing that there are many years of effort behind that website, and what are we going to do? This is all work that's paralleled by many, many others. I think of places like the Vintage Computer Federation, who I do lots of work with, or the Strong Museum of Play. I think about people like Russ Kick of the Memory Hole, or Frank Cifaldi of the Video Game History Foundation. There's people like Ashley Bluer, who does lots of work in audio-video preservation. Laurie Emerson, who works at the Media Archaeology Lab she put together out in Colorado. There's a gentleman named Ben Fino-Rodden, who I absolutely adore. He is involved now in both preservation and presentation in display spaces. He used to work for the Museum of Modern Art, and now he works on his own as a consultant. Dragan Eppenscheid, Olia Liana. These are names that I have picked up and met the people behind, and in many cases stayed at their homes or gotten into projects with them. But people who are outside of the nitty-gritty of digital preservation might not know these names. And I will assure you, there are hundreds of people laboring really intensively to bring old computer history back to life. So it is for Archive Team. Besides me being the loudmouth, top hat wearing face of Archive Team, there are dozens of people working behind the scenes to make sure that stuff happens. Go on to the Archive Team Wiki at archiveteam.org. You'll see all sorts of names that aren't mine and that are putting hours and hours a day into the dream of Archive Team. But for some, I am nothing but Archive Team. I think part of that is just people always confuse the lead singer for being the band. They always confuse the spokesman for being the company. And sometimes they just make the mistake of going for the brightest, loudest person as obviously being in charge. That's just not the case. Archive Team was founded by multiple people who took an idea that I had and combined it with ideas they had already had and just gave it a branding. But over time, I become the sole founder of Archive Team. And I really feel bad about that because these are folks, some of whom have moved on to other things, who have played an incredible part in what's going on. But a little more about how I ended up here. Part of it is that I have been weirdly consistent for many, many years. My initial impulse when I encounter something beautiful and unique is to in some way ensure its longevity. Now, sometimes it's not possible to do so. You'll have a conflagration of people who all assemble in one place and then they all go away. While I would love for that moment and that party to live forever, it's not going to. But maybe taking a picture or recording someone speaking or shooting some video when you are in a place that many other people are but nobody has a video camera, you do a little part to keep some of that alive beyond that. And people who weren't there or didn't even know it existed, they appreciate what you've done. When I was collecting BBS text files in my early teens, I got rewarded by people really enjoying the text files, even by the end of the 1980s, about bulletin board systems that had been gone. Printing out old discussions or BBS messages, they've done nothing but increase in value for people who want to see what messages were like from the dawn of the BBS all the way through to the 1990s cyberpunk era. People want to know what people were talking about back then, even if it's just merely a smaller, more constrained version of what people talk about now. Similarly, I've been able to get my hands on caches of material, and my first impulse has always been to immediately get it somewhere that the maximum number of people can enjoy it, or, if they prefer, just download it. Now, that's hardly a foundation for celebrity. And I think part of what combined with that impulse was the fact that I love to speak in public, as I discussed on a previous episode. I love getting out in front of crowds and talking about something that I care about. And so people will see this person who is flamboyant and loud and can simply describe complicated things and then come up with conclusions and ideas that they can take away easily. That's my gig. I love doing that. I love walking up in front of a crowd who have kind of a light knowledge of something and having them walk away knowing more, feeling energized, and wanting to support the things that I care about. I don't expect to raise an army. I don't expect to find followers and then make them do whatever I do. I just want people to be aware of a world outside of their experience, or to know more about a world that they want to experience. Those are the best talks, and that's the best thing that I think a person can provide to other people during something like a presentation. And I want an audience to feel good about the things they experience, and I want the audience to feel good about what I'm presenting to them. I like making people happy. Oh, sure, I do get acerbic. Let's not act like I'm an angel here, but I also think that if all you do all day is make people feel bad and step in people's faces for your own glory and enjoyment and tweaking a bunch of noses, it corrodes you as a person. It makes you into something that, believe me, something terrible that will stick to you and then never come off. And never go away. I'll tell you, I guess my weird secrets might help you, with the caveat that it might not work at all. So the first thing is really to focus on what you are doing and what matters to you without being concerned purely about an end run to celebrity. Dance like nobody is watching, because there's no reason for you to go through life acting like something you're not for the sake of some sort of performative existence. I think that it's one of those things that can just build up into your life until you don't even recognize you're not being yourself. So being who you are is incredibly important. I think that if you have goals, that working towards them without wondering if you're going to get awards or accolades or get some large follower count or whatever other metric is in your mind, I think that's one of the paths to success. Because eventually, the people who recognize you, whether it's a small audience or a worldwide one, will appreciate the honesty at which you do your project. Now, what your project is, that's maybe a question that needs to be asked too. Maybe you're somebody who likes to write, somebody who likes to make music. Maybe you're somebody who likes to compile collections of things. And one approach that may help when you're doing your thing and your project is set it up so that if when you die, someone stumbles upon it, they are impressed. They are really understanding of what you were trying to do, and they internalize it. It may sound like a weird and possibly depressing mind game, but understanding that what you're working on may not have you around to give context is actually the very nature of celebrity. I mean, people construct images of celebrities in their mind because the celebrity cannot come to their house and give them all of the ideas that they had behind whatever they're famous for. You know, you don't get people, you get what they did, the results of their life's effort, and that's all you get to go on. Another hint from me is to let go of this illusion that everything you do will be understood and will be loved by everyone else, because I have discovered just watching some of the most universally should be loved things get trashed by a small and vocal minority who won't give up. And those folks will be there. And unfortunately, in the modern era, the landscape has flattened enough so that a person who hates things can acquire as much of a voice as somebody who adores it online. You can post something that is actually pretty fun and neat, and all it'll take is one or two people who have some sort of a chip or some sort of a weird idea about what you are and what you represent, and they can ruin your whole day. You know, someday we'll figure out how to engineer part of that away, but I don't think we'll ever get it away completely. Folks used to write awful things all the time to every television star, every magazine of any circulation, and to every radio station. And those things would be filtered out and you wouldn't hear them. They'd go into the cranks file. They'd be acknowledged as, yeah, a lot of people are getting angry about this. Now let's make some sort of a decision. But they wouldn't become as important as the thing being said and being presented 1 millimeter on the screen away from somebody else's hard work. Regardless, working on the thing that you do without worrying about those loudmouth nothings related to your efforts, to me, is one of the paths of success. And people will notice that you are continuing your efforts and believing in what you do. And however big that audience is going to be an honest group of people that you have earned out of hard work and consistency. Now, like I said, sometimes you end up with these incredibly large audiences, usually because there's some sort of quirk. Somebody misstates what you do, or they come up with a way of describing it that's not quite accurate, but attracts a lot of eyeballs, and then suddenly you're everywhere. And I will tell you that that is a both breathtaking and terrifying experience. And I consider myself one of the luckiest people in the world, both generally, but also because of an event around Sockington the Cat. Now, if you haven't heard of Sockington the Cat, he's on Twitter as Sockington, S-O-C-K-I-N-G-T-O-N. And Sockington was and is a cat that my ex-wife and I owned together. And when Twitter was created in 2007, I created an account for the cat and started tweeting as the cat. And it was a lot of fun. It was just tweeting the weirdness of this weird little real cat that was in my life. And I also would take photos of him, and he's a very beautiful cat. And so this cat got to be on Twitter and had a few hundred followers over time because it was weird how this cat was Twittering. But eventually, it was a default account on Twitter. This was just because of one Twitter founder, BizStone, B-I-Z, creating a default users list that people would be automatically subscribed to as representative of Twitter, and Sockington got on that list. So a guy I've never met decided to put a cat account into a list somewhere in California, and suddenly my cat went from a couple hundred followers to a couple thousand to a couple hundred thousand to 1.4 million, where he is now. And that has nothing to do with years of work, years of effort, skill, quality, talent. It's just the fact that the cat happened to be right place, right time. But for some reason, when it hit 500,000 followers, it suddenly got into the news, right? Cat has 500,000 followers on Twitter. This got into the AP Newswire. It got onto television. It got everywhere because for some reason, that particular number set off stuff about the cat. Now, there was a local news station that had a person that was willing to come to the house because many of them wanted me to bring the cat to them. And he came and he recorded an interview with me, and then they filmed the cat for a little while and then went off and made a little story about the cat. Now, the news person who interviewed me, this guy had been involved as a string reporter since something like 1983. He'd been in the Boston area doing all sorts of news work for decades, but he was still willing to come out and do a stupid internet cat story. So he is the persistent working hero here, not me. So he did the story and it got picked up immediately worldwide. So there was footage of the cat and there was the story of the cat on news programs in England and all over the United States and in a couple other European countries. And people were contacting me and they were also joining the cat on Twitter. And so the cat eventually hit 1 million, which, by the way, never really got much news. It wasn't as interesting. The news was 500,000. I'm still fascinated that that's what happened. Somewhere there in the white hot lava, the Mordor of celebrity, came the experience of your cat. And I don't mean me. I mean my cat being contacted by a whole range of product endorsements, biographers, book writers who wanted the cat to be a part of their endeavor. They would find phone numbers and they would call us. They sent the cat products with the cat's face on it. This still happens, by the way. There is a litter box company that sends boxes of litter with Sockington's face on it in the hope that he'll tweet about it. There are people who will come up with a product like a laser pointer for cats that can be activated over the internet, and they want Sockington involved. There was a genetic company that wanted to do Sockington's biological history, DNA-wise. They still wanted money for it, so that didn't happen. There was a group that wanted to make a doll of Sockington, t-shirts of Sockington, and the list, I must stress, goes on and on and on. And living this life of this bizarre cat being famous and having it not be me, right? If I was the one who was famous, it would be very hard to discern my personal identity with the identity that people want, and there'd be a lot of real pressure to act like the thing people thought was famous. But when it's a cat, you're able to kind of set aside yourself and look at what the cat is experiencing. And the answer is, it's all utter garbage. It's just people going after other people to get something, whether it's some light on themselves, to make money off of you, to become cool in the eyes of others because they're affiliated with you. It's all of this horrifying transactional meaninglessness that let me know that celebrity in any form is really a kind of drug that can overdose with very little effort. My cat, of course, was oblivious to all of this. Sockington used the litter box, sat on a couch, and occasionally somebody would come by and put a camera in his face, which he may or may not have been interested in. While the Sockington account continues to have a lot of followers and still gets a lot of attention in certain kinds of realms, that white-hot period has long passed. I never tried to turn Sockington into Grumpy Cat which for me is the template of where Sockington could have gone. The brand items, the terrible movie, the weird books, the videos, all of that could have been Sockington's life, and I am so glad that it never ended up being the case. So, talking about all this can come off as possibly an ego trip or being self-serving, but I really want people to know that on the other side of any kind of perceived celebrity is a person who lives a life and is a normal human being with ups, downs, flaws, moments of grace, moments of terribleness, and you live your life sometimes in the public eye. And when you live your life in the public eye, you can find yourself being judged by weird criteria or being whipped into things that you never knew you would be. And what I have discovered is that it's a matter of using whatever this weird little power is for ever how long it is, and using it to shine a light in spaces and places and people that maybe deserve it so much more than you. And letting the world know how much more there is to admire and respect about those people. So for whatever amount the world's light has fallen into my personal bucket, I like to think that the rest of my life will be spent scooping up some of that light and shining it into so many good things that deserve it so much more. This has been Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Baekhoyanu, Sam Johnston, and the hundreds of other Patreon supporters who have made this podcast possible. As this podcast comes out, a milestone will be reached. As you know, I had a heart attack back in 2017, and I had it in Australia, which turns out to have much, much better health care in terms of cost than I would ever get in America. The kind of heart attack I had and the amount of work that was done would have easily crossed past $250,000 in America. In Australia, it was only 19,000 Australian dollars, which works out to about 16,000 American dollars. Truly a bargain. I applied under my health insurance to have that paid, and the health insurance company, because it was dealing with an Australian company, super dragged its feet, and it wasn't totally paid off until this month. And so when everything was said and done, when everything was put together, it turned out that I owe 534 American dollars to this Australian hospital. And thanks to this podcast, it wasn't even a consideration for me. I'm paying it off immediately as you listen to this podcast. So as of this podcast, my medical debt to all of my different concerns, whether it was my actual doctor here and to the doctors in Australia, everybody's square. So I owe nothing for medical debt anywhere in my life. I am completely medical debt free. And as time goes on, I'm sure I'll rack up a bill here or bill there, but I'm going to pay them off as they come. Thank you so much to everybody who has given me support. And let's hope that I don't need that level of medical care again anytime soon.